My name is Deborah Harsma. I am president of BioLogos, and it's great to be here at ASA. I think I went to my first meeting in the 90s, but I haven't been to one in the last few years since COVID, so I'm excited to be back and see everyone. It's my pleasure tonight to introduce my friend, Dr. Praveen Sethapathy, who we get to hear tonight. Praveen is an amazing research scientist. He has nearly 150 research publications. He is a leader in physiological genomics. He's a professor at Cornell University, where he is also chair of the Department of Biomedical Sciences, and director of the Cornell Center of Vertebrate Genomics. His lab focuses on genome scale and molecular approaches to understanding physiology and human disease, including diabetes. It's really an amazing career. So I encourage you, students and early career scientists, this is a great role model of an excellent scientist. But even more, he's a great role model of being a Christian in academia, of following Christ, of what that looks like. Praveen has a humble and wise character. He's on my board at BioLogos, so I've had a chance to interact with him there many times over recent years, and so value his input there. He has been open about his faith on campus his whole career. He's not succumbed to that academic rat race. He's kept a good balance. He's raising a family with three kids, and he's staying involved in his church, and he's serving multiple science and faith organizations. He's mentoring early career scientists in their walk with God. So tonight, we will get to hear his experiences and his testimony, yes?
Yes.
He has an amazing testimony. You're going to love it. And we'll get to hear his reflections on diversity. I remember in 2020, there was the shooting of George Floyd, and the months following that, all of the turmoil and all of us were looking for how can we do better in diversity? And I remember Praveen talking about what he was doing with his lab, with his group, and having them read articles and do discussions. And he was already thinking about maybe we can get the university to do this. Lots changed since 2020. Like now just DEI has become this lightning rod of a term. And yet we are seeking, as Christ followers, what does it mean to be the body of Christ together? And that is a value here at ASA. And I'm really looking forward to what Praveen has to share with us tonight. So please welcome Dr. Praveen Sethapathy.
Thank you so much, Deb. Really appreciate that warm and kind introduction. And it's so wonderful to see all of you here and filling this hall. Many of the science faith talks that I've given have focused on topics such as, is there harmony between science and faith? Or what does it mean to be human? What is scripture and what is our faith, but also what does my work in science teach me about what it means to be human? Today it's going to be different. I thought it was really inspired, the topic or the theme for ASA's conference this year, and it challenged me to think about something new and fresh to say, and maybe even dig a little deeper back into my own life and history, and share some personal stories with you. So I hope you appreciate and enjoy this journey that we're going to be on for the next 40 minutes or so. But if you don't, not to worry, they've lined up a much better slate of speakers after me, so it's going to be fine. So autumn, fall, has always been my favorite season, as far back as I can remember. It's not because of the apple picking, or the colorful foliage, or the crisp morning air in upstate New York, where I grew up. I do love all those things, but they're not why autumn feels like home to me. The fall season reminds me of the first time I felt American. And there's one reason why: football. Though I was born in Canada, and I lived the first 4 years of my life in the United States, my earliest memories of childhood are from kindergarten and first grade in Chennai, India. My first language was Tamil. My favorite music was from Indian cinema. The action hero I favored wasn't Superman or He-Man, but superstar Rajinikanth, an actor who was all the rage back in 1980s Chennai. When I arrived back in Western New York for second grade, I was a fish way out of water. I didn't know, sound like, or look like anybody else there. I tried to make friends, but I would inevitably slip up, say something culturally inappropriate using my sort of British Indian English. Like the time I innocently complimented a boy's attire by saying, "Nice dress." I was not fitting in. I spent much of the year in the corner of the classroom reading and sometimes wondering whether I was really American. Many immigrants have lived some version of this story. On the first day of school the next year, third grade, something changed. I met my third grade teacher, Mrs. Malik. She had a sweet, inviting smile, was always kind, never treated me differently than the other kids in the class. But what I remember most about her was her contagious passion for the Buffalo Bills. She was a fanatic. All Bills, all the time, from her clothing to her classroom decor, all the math questions were about the Bills. I started watching football too. If this was good enough for Mrs. Malik, it was good enough for me. And I too fell in love. I didn't particularly understand the sport at first, but the more I watched and the more I talked with it about it with my teacher, the more I started to bleed red, white, and blue. Not only because those are the colors of the Bills uniforms, but also because it was at that point I felt American for the first time. Football is as uniquely American as baseball and hot dogs. But baseball sort of bored me, sorry. And I was and still am a vegetarian. So football became my gateway to America. I was a fan of the Buffalo Bills. I felt as though I belonged. My most salient and fond memories of childhood all center on the Bills. I remember praying earnestly to God that kicker Scott Norwood would make the late game field goal in Super Bowl against the Giants. He didn't. Did have a crisis of faith. Wide right, these are not words a Bills fan wants to hear. I remember one of the best gifts my father ever gave me was a winter jacket, a Bills winter jacket. I treasured it for years. I remember writing a poem about the Buffalo Bills with my sister and having it published in the local newspaper. I still have the poem today. I remember the exhilaration I felt when an autographed photo of Bills QB Jim Kelly arrived in the mail, and I've since passed that on to my son. I remember playing ping pong in the basement of our home for 3 hours while the entire family listened on the radio to the Bills storm back from a 32-point deficit to beat the Houston Oilers in what became known until recently as the greatest comeback in NFL history. And it's one of the best family memories I have to this day. I also remember lying in bed after each of the 4 straight Super Bowl losses, suffocating in the pain of each loss. But in victory or defeat, I was a part of something. I was a part of what has come to be known as Bills Mafia. I was a part of American football. I was American. I don't need football to feel American today. I know that I'm American and that I'm Indian. And I'm very proud of both. But I will never forget that as a little brown kid with an accent trying to find his place, football was the first thing that gave me something to be a part of. If I saw a fellow Bills fan in the grocery store or the doctor's office or the airport, all decorum would go out the window and go Bills. I still do that. In that moment, I would feel seen. Sure, those moments are fleeting, but as a young kid, they added up to something real, a sense that I belonged. And the thing about belonging is it begets confidence. And confidence gives you the courage to hope, to dream, to be the best version of yourself. One autumn day, a few years ago, walking back to my office on the Cornell campus after a lecture I had given in a physiology course that I direct, I was thinking about this story of belonging from my childhood. The top performing student in the class was a young black man. He was engaged, sharp, asked better questions than most. But despite his clear penchant for the subject matter and his near perfect exam grades, I couldn't shake the feeling that he felt a little uncomfortable, a little out of place, almost as though he was trying to prove himself every class. I would later talk to other students of color in the class who shared with me that the energy that they spent on a daily basis convincing themselves they belonged. In my lectures, I gave brief historical asides on various pioneers who made important discoveries that helped shape the various concepts I was teaching. I used the same examples I had been taught when I was a student. They were almost all white men of European descent. The cadre of great thinkers and scholars I taught about was largely devoid of women, persons of color, of those who looked and talked like most of the world, and certainly many of my students. We are fond of saying at Cornell that the world comes to us. We do have an incredibly diverse student body, a wide range of international students as well from over 130 countries. Once on our campus, though, it is not uncommon for these students to be enveloped in incomplete and even false narratives of scientific progress. Science isn't just a collection of facts. It's an endeavor taken up by complex people who are reflections of their time and place, who carry with them intricate stories that shape their work and its interpretation. So who are the people we're studying and teaching? Which kind of work and what sort of institutions and societies are represented? I took a hard look at the historical examples I was providing in my class. I decided to address my own ignorance of the varied contributions to physiology beyond only those that had been taught to me. A whole world of remarkable scientific thinkers and innovators, many nearly lost to history, was opened up to me. Now in my class, students can see that we are indebted not only to Claude Cournot, the French anatomist who revolutionized liver surgery, but also to Percy Julian, the first African-American chemist inducted into the National Academy of Sciences, who revolutionized the treatment of rheumatoid arthritis. Claude is featured in most medical textbooks. Percy is barely known to many students today. Students now hear the familiar name Louis Pasteur, who of course changed public health. But in my class, they will hear right alongside his contemporary, Sarah Josephine Baker, a gay woman who nearly single-handedly revitalized child hygiene in America and more than halved infant mortality in New York City in the early 1900s. She's a hero. Students didn't know about her. Students learn not only about the public health problems facing Native Americans today, they also hear about the inspiring Native American surgeon, Lori Alvord, who still today is changing the way medicine is practiced, thoughtfully blending Western techniques with ancient Navajo practices. I didn't bring about this change in my course because of a new DEI initiative on campus, or a performative box check to convince the administration that I was paying attention to diversity. I made this change because the truth matters. I think we would all agree here, as Christians, the truth matters. A truer representation of the diverse shoulders on which we stand today as scientists is the first step toward belonging. Simply bringing together a diverse group of people is not enough to make magic happen, unless each of the individuals there feel connected to the past that has shaped what we are today, which in turn begets the confidence that they can be a part of shaping the future. Struck by how many great thinkers and scholars in science have not been given the credit that they're due, I started in my lab a program that Deb alluded to called Truthful Recognition of Unsung Excellence, or TRU. This has been successfully running for several years now. Every other week, someone in my lab is signed up to research and then present on an individual whose work is foundational for our own endeavors in science and medicine, but who have not been appropriately recognized, are not included typically in the pantheon of leaders about whom we're taught, and therefore are mostly unknown to students and even most teachers today. This program, TRU, it serves as a constant reminder to me and my entire lab that we stand on the shoulders of many, many different kinds of scholars. We know that by speaking them and their work back into the front of our minds, we draw inspiration from a broader collection of thinkers and innovators. This diversity matters in part because, as I mentioned, it offers a truer picture, a more faithful representation of the face of a scholar, which builds confidence and hope in every student. But diversity also matters in science for reasons beyond representation and belonging. Another major reason is that diversity challenges the parochialism that often plagues our thinking and unnecessarily stunts our creativity. I believe, and I suspect many of you do too, that the lifeblood of a vibrant scientific enterprise is fresh perspectives. We don't attend scientific conferences on a regular basis so that we can keep hearing the same things over and over again and pat ourselves on the back, although sometimes it feels like that. Rather, we want to hear what's new. What fresh angles and ideas and paradigms are going to offer sometimes new, sometimes complementary ways of thinking about a complex problem. Working in an environment with voices from people of diverse backgrounds, upbringings, experiences, and motivations, they keep you questioning assumptions, keep you from becoming too comfortable or complacent. A former provost of Stanford University gave a speech a number of years ago on groupthink in the academy. He called this the threat from within. Quote, "We need to resist the external threats to our mission, but in this we have many friends from outside the university willing and able to help. But to stem or dial back our academic parochialism, we are pretty much on our own. The first step is to remind our students and colleagues that those who hold views contrary to one's own are rarely ever evil or stupid, and they may know and understand things that we do not. It is only when we start with this assumption that rational discourse can begin and that the winds of freedom can blow." This is true in the scientific enterprise as much as it is in the administration of a university. As chair of my department, as director of a campus center, and as a head of a research lab, I have found repeatedly that when I am not intentional about weaving different perspectives into the fabric of my vision or my purpose, it is very easy to stagnate and to settle into a sort of self-satisfied posture that stymies creativity, prevents growth, and limits potential. Decades of research has shown that more diverse groups of people tend to be more creative, more innovative, able to tackle harder problems. In my own lab, students are encouraged to speak out of their own background and experience. Conversations made possible by diverse voices in my lab has directly led to more creative science, including, but not limited to, considering for the first time how ancestry and socioeconomic factors might shape the biology of a very specific cell type that we study, but that had previously thought to already be fairly well understood. Or considering how certain practices from specific ancient cultures might inform the scientific questions we should, but are not asking about physiology and health. You need not go any further than organismal biology to see how wholeness depends upon diversity. Consider the human body with me for a second. Many of you already know one of the most remarkable discoveries in the study of the human body in the recent past is that we are home to tens of trillions of microbes. So if you put that in another way, about half, maybe slightly more than half of the cells in the human body are not human at all. Most of these are bacteria, viruses, but did you know that some of them are fungus too? You may be used to thinking about fungus in the context of a medical condition or a yeast infection or even edible mushrooms or something you may drink. But across the human population, hundreds of fungal species take up normal residence inside our body. And amazingly, these bacteria, these fungi, these viruses, they work together to promote our good health and physical well-being. So it's not just that they're there, we depend upon them. And they seem to play a role in shaping our emotions and our moods and our behaviors. We're still working out a lot of the details of how they do those things, but they do seem to be critical to our well-being and our systemic health. We simply wouldn't be who we are without these microbes that take up normal residence in various tissues of our body. Another interesting example comes from examining DNA. Many people assume that our DNA is fully human. It's a natural assumption. But actually, speckled throughout our genome are genetic sequences that originated from viruses. And this is because certain viruses, when they infect a host, they can integrate their genetic material into that of the host. In fact, depending on how you count, at least 10% of our human genome represents sequences from viruses that have integrated into our DNA over time. So even at the genetic level, each of us is 1/10 virus. And amazingly, viral DNA may have actually shaped some aspects of human biology that we take for granted today. For example, this is one of my favorites, it gives me goosebumps to think about it. There's growing evidence to suggest that pieces of viral DNA may have been co-opted and now contribute to the development of the human placenta. It's fascinating to me that viral DNA may have helped bring about an organ that is critical for nourishing a growing baby in the human womb. We are not as homogeneous as we assume, and physically independent from other species as we might like to think. And our own bodies are all the evidence we need of that truth. This is a striking reminder that we belong to one diverse ecological and societal body. A body with many different parts, each with a responsibility toward another, each contributing to the wholeness of the sum. And this takes us back to the verses from Paul that Mike shared earlier. This has been true in my life, not only in science, but also in my walk with Christ. To explain this, I need to first briefly share my testimony, so please bear with me. I was raised as a Hindu for 18 years. I appreciated Hinduism as a rich culture to enjoy, but it wasn't until my college years that I realized I didn't really know much about it, or really, and importantly, what it meant to me personally. I had gone through the motions of various aspects of Hinduism and was familiar with many of the traditions and stories of the faith. But I realized I had no idea what it meant to me personally. I hadn't really stopped to think about it. I became intrigued by Hinduism and how it compared with other religions. So over the course of several years, I attempted to read the scriptures from many different faith traditions, including Hinduism, but also Buddhism, Islam, and Christianity. So, to cut to the chase, I stand before you as a Christian today. What was it that stood out for me in Christianity? As cliche as it may sound, it was meeting the character of Jesus. He's the supposed hero of the story, and yet he appears as a naked, disfigured, pathetic, dying man on a cross. It was hard to get through. It wasn't the superhero Rama or Krishna from Hinduism that I so enjoyed and was used to reading about and strongly resonated with. I too would love to become 60 feet tall and throw my chakra at someone who disrespected me. It was not even like the valiant Muhammad, who I would eventually spend some time studying. One of the first things I would learn, though, is that in the cross, Jesus was turning upside down my notions of power. He wasn't on the cross because he was powerless to stop it. He was on the cross because that's just how far he would go to exercise his power to fix a broken world, to make things new. You and I perhaps often exercise power by forcing our authority or perceived superiority on the world. Jesus exercised his power by laying his life down before the world. He was choosing to use his power completely for the benefit of others and not himself. I'd never really read anything like this before. It was truly radical. It didn't make me a Christian, but it intrigued me. And it made me want to deepen my knowledge of this person. It was the first time I had read a religious text and began to wonder whether I was really pursuing a person and not just a collection of ideas. Stripped of Christ, Christianity was no more or less compelling to me than a lot of other faith traditions. The golden rule is not uniquely biblical. Derivatives of it are present in other faith traditions. What other faith traditions didn't have, though, was this person, Jesus. He made all the difference. Eventually, I would surrender my life to Christ. And when I started following Jesus and finding my identity in him, it was a confusing time for my family. Was I rejecting my roots? My Indian culture? Would I change my name? Would I suddenly become John? Or maybe Peter? And you know, their confusion was not unfounded. Many before me in a similar position had done exactly that. But Christ did not come to change names or to move people from one culture to another. He came to renew hearts and minds and to bring life where there was death. So it was my joy to share with my family that I would very much remain Praveen Sethupathi, that Christ was laying a claim on my heart, not on my name. I explained that becoming Christian had nothing to do with rejecting my Indian heritage or being called by a different name. It was about embracing God's interwoven presence in the history of mankind, Christ's love and sacrifice for us, and our desperate need for him. Christ was brewing within me a renewed sense of purpose and commitment to others and passion for justice. All this happened when I was 19, 20 years old. If you'd watched the first 18 years of my life unfold, you would not have predicted this transformation at all. During a lot of that time, three of the largest influences in my life outside of my father were Hindu mythology, American alternative rock music, and the Japanese language and culture. That sounds like a motley crew. It is, so let me explain. I grew up kind of with two lives. One was inside the home and the other was outside the home. Inside, although we were in rural America, it was like we had not left India. Walking through the front door every day was like stepping back into a portal. Took me back to a different time and place. I was enveloped in the smells of incense, the sounds of ancient Sanskrit prayers, and Hindu mythology. I was steeped in it. I didn't think much about whether I liked it or not. It was just home. When I stepped out to go to school, though, I was plunged back in the reality of life in rural America. I wasn't allowed to watch a lot of TV or movies, and I was expected to get right back home after school, so I wasn't really that clued in to the latest cultural happenings. But I did have a Walkman, a portable cassette player, which allowed me to dive into the burgeoning music of the era, Pearl Jam, and Nirvana, Smashing Pumpkins, Collective Soul. They afforded me the chance to escape for a little while, to find a home away from home. And then there was Sunday morning. Not church, Japanese class. Every Sunday morning for 8 years, my dad took us to the local college where he worked, and the head of the math department, who happened to be from Japan, would teach me and my older brother Japanese for 2 hours. Again, I didn't really think about it much as just what we did. I got used to the idea that on any given week, my closest companions would be Hindu stories, alternative rock music, and Japanese culture. I had no idea then that these three very companions would one day strengthen me in Christ. After becoming Christian, I wrestled at various times with the concept of Christ as both king and servant. The very paradox that compelled me toward him was the stumbling block to fully grasping him. What helped me most was a Hindu story from my childhood of the noble Rantideva. It was an ancient king in Indian lore who offered everything he possessed for the needs of his subjects, even to the point of his own destitution and near death. Rantideva was a picture of true kingship, true biblical kingship, though Rantideva probably didn't know it. The notion that to rule your subjects is actually to serve them unto death. Though Rantideva is mythological, his story was the one that helped cement for me the idea of Jesus as the ultimate servant king. And what it really means in Genesis 1:26, that we, as images of God, have royal dominion over creation. Jesus also said, "He without sin cast the first stone," right? This sort of censuring of standing in judgment of others is powerful. But I have to confess, it really came alive the most to me when I remembered one of my favorite alternative rock songs from the 90s. It's "What It's Like" by Everlast. In it, Everlast sings of a woman who has made a choice deemed to be immoral by onlookers. And he says, "God forbid you ever had to walk a mile in her shoes. Then you really might know what it's like to have to choose." Without meaning to, Everlast brought Jesus' words to life for me in a way that nothing else had. To see every person as an image of Christ, which of course is the real wonder and surprise that Christianity brought to the world. I have also in my Christian life wrestled with embracing brokenness. I wanted to find beauty in brokenness. And often I did. But other times I found it frustrating, even depressing. I wanted it to go away. I tried to will it away, but it remained ever present. But I was missing the point. One of the ideas that helped me most was kintsugi, the Japanese art form of mending broken pottery with gold lacquer. This technique, it treats repeated breaks not as something to be hidden or be ashamed of, but to be illuminated. I realized that our eyes are specially drawn to the repairs, which define the art. Just as we want others' eyes drawn to Christ's healing work in our broken lives, which is at the center of our beauty. And ancient Japanese art is what taught me to fully embrace the work that Jesus was doing in my heart. Hindu mythology, American alternative rock, and Japanese culture were my companions and influences in early life, and this is the diverse crew God used to draw me closer to him. This teaches me that God has a sense of humor, and also that the truth of God, the fingerprints of God, the grace of God, cannot be contained. They are taught in the Bible, but they are also revealed constantly across time and all over the world. God spoke to Moses in a burning bush. He spoke to Elijah in a whisper. He spoke to Balaam through a donkey, and he spoke to me through a mythological Hindu king, the Muslim rocker Everlast, and an ancient East Asian art form. I have often experienced in American Christian culture a sort of fear of the unknown, a defensive and sometimes even angry posture against the wiles of the world. But my experience has been quite to the contrary. I've found great joy in a diverse array of traditions and cultures, revealing new touch points with Christ that I never could have imagined, helping me to see him and understand him in ways that I had been failing to up until then. It has also helped me to see my non-Christian colleagues not as opponents or even as ministry projects, but as images of God, from whom I may learn something new about Christ. That's a different posture altogether toward the idea of evangelism. Diversity of people, diversity of experiences, diversity of ideas, these aren't just boxes to check to satisfy wokeism or a DEI thing or whatever somebody else might say to confuse us about what it looks like to build a community of diverse voices. Diversity is necessary for representation and belonging, which my 7-year-old self would tell you is essential for building confidence and courage to be the best version of me. Diversity is also foundational for creativity, understanding, and growth as a scientist and also as a follower of Christ. Thank you very much.
We're so thankful, Praveen. That was such a beautiful portrayal of how diversity works in our faith life. I love it. We now have time, quite a bit of time, for questions. Can I start by asking you a question? You talked about that sense of belonging when you were a child and how you felt American when you learned about football and became a Buffalo Bills fan. Are there stories from later in your lifetimes when in the scientific world or even in the church you were made to feel like you didn't belong or that was a struggle for you?
Thanks, Deb, for the question. I have actually always struggled to feel like I belong. There are times where I have felt like just when I feel like I'm finding my people, a really stark difference will be highlighted that will remind me that I don't quite fit in there. But over time, I think as a child, that was really tough. These days, I find myself smiling when that happens because I know that all we can really do on this side of heaven is to image and mirror as best as we can the belonging that Christ offers us. But, you know, as that song goes from Chris Rice, I think the title of it is Belong. He talks about that moment when he realized that the Father has offered him his name. That's all the belonging Chris ever needed, and it's all the belonging I need. So when I struggle to belong now, that's where I go.
Beautiful. Okay.
Hi, I wanted to thank you so much for that's the most beautiful talk I have heard in a very long time. So one of the thing I wanted to ask you about is we heard a lot about hostility towards faith on campus, and I was wondering if you've experienced any of that as an academic and or either from students or students that are trying to find their own faith and yet they're in the sciences and that's difficult.
Great. Thank you so much for that question and for your kind words. It's really nice. It's an excellent question. I myself have not actually encountered a lot of overt and open criticism or challenge to me as a Christian, despite the fact that I've been very open about it from the beginning. But I think part of the reason for that is what a lot of our academic colleagues really want to see is excellence. And when we commit ourselves to excellence and we care deeply about our own work, the work of our colleagues, the progress of our department, the well-being of our institution, people see that. I don't mean to be Pollyanna about it, but I do think that 9 times out of 10, people are willing to put up with idiosyncrasies or other kinds of things they may not otherwise like to see in you if they feel as though you are an important contributor to the community, right? So I always emphasize to students who are wrestling with what it looks like. So the first part of your ministry is pursuing excellence in the name of God, right? To the best of your ability. People will see that that drive, that motivation, that desire, and they might even ask, where does that come from, right? Which provides a wonderful opportunity to be able to talk about your faith. To the second question that you asked, I have been really passionate in my life about providing open spaces for students to be able to wrestle with really hard questions at the intersection of science and faith. And a lot of that comes from the fact that in my own experience, I didn't have that. So as a new Christian going off to graduate school and being told by ministry leaders that I was interacting with that I should go into the vanguard of academia and dismantle evolution, this was what I was being told. So working through that on my own was really, really difficult. And it gave me a passion for creating safe spaces where people can come and wrestle. And I would tell them from the get-go, I'm not going to know the answers to half or more than half of your questions. This isn't about tutelage as much as it is about us as brothers of Christ wrestling together. You know, when I was a postdoc with Francis, that's what he did for me. And, you know, we would have these wonderful moments where it was very clear who the mentor was and who the mentee was. And then we would transition like this to a moment where it was brother to brother. And this is what I've endeavored to do with students on my campus. And word just sort of spreads. There's a word of mouth and all kinds of students, people who have been mired in fundamentalism, who are sort of looking both ways and wondering whether they really should ask the question that's about to come out of their mouths, to students from the other side of the spectrum. And there's no judgment. This is a place where if you have an honest and genuine question, you can ask it and we can talk together.
Praveen, thank you so much. I'm really inspired by your talk and about your True initiative that you have done on campus. Can you tell me more about if you've had thoughts of other campuses following suit and if you've talked to colleagues in different colleges and universities and if they've thought, oh, not even just for DEI, but for something of that belonging and representation and celebration of scientists and people that they want to adopt something similar. Tell us about a little bit of that.
Yeah, thank you for that question. So what I'm really pleased and excited about is the Biomedical and Biological Sciences graduate program at Cornell, which is the umbrella program. It has adopted a version of True, which we do in our lab. So I'm really excited about that because now the footprint of the program and the students that get to participate in it is much broader than it would be otherwise just in my lab. I will say that it's not a mandate of the program. It's more of an idea that is presented to PIs as something that they can incorporate in their lab meetings should they choose to. And I would say that maybe a third to half have chosen to do it to some extent or the other. So adoption is probably going to be an issue, getting people to think, do I really want precious time in my lab meetings dedicated to this? So I think you have to have the value first before you can really implement it in a way that is going to be effective. I haven't thought too much about its implementation beyond the Cornell campus, for example, but conversations are starting to happen. It's more of a word of mouth thing, but I think Deb alluded to the fact that I'm a mentor for early career Christian faculty through the Veritas Faculty Summit program. And I've shared this with them, and many of those PIs are starting to think about implementing it in their labs. So it's a little bit of a grassroots type of thing right now. Yeah.
Thank you, Praveen. As a fellow immigrant, I've met a couple of other ASA attendees who are also shared that immigrant story. And I think the challenge is, you mentioned straddling both worlds as you walked into your home. So the question is, can you tell us, are there lessons learned from you balancing the two worlds and how they can inform how we share the science and faith conversation, or even when we straddle difficult conversations in the world today, how have your experience as an immigrant balancing that translated over to carrying those kind of difficult conversations?
Say, that's a great question. And I hope this answers it at least to some extent, because the first thing that comes to mind for me is I always really reveled in the fact that even as a young boy, I would go back and forth between American and Indian music flawlessly. There would be no hitch, no sort of, oh, let me get into a different gear. I just went smoothly from one to the other, and I loved that I could do that. But that sense of pride, which is not perhaps the most helpful thing, evolved into something actually more constructive, and that is that I began to realize that a kind of consistent exposure to even two or three dimensions of diversity made me so much more sensitive to what else was out there, so much more eager to want to know about my colleagues' experiences or their backgrounds or their language. So when I was in college, I had friends from all across the world, and I learned just a little bit from each of their languages, right, just to see their face light up. Right? So those kinds of things, I don't think I would have thought about that unless I had had the upbringing that I did, where I was sort of experiencing two very, very different cultures. So that's sort of the positive side of it, right? And there were all kinds of challenging and difficult and negative aspects to trying to balance and figure out who I was. There was a thing in the 80s and 90s about ABCD, American Born Confused Desi, which is just like Indian Americans just not knowing who they are, right? And I went through so much of that kind of experience as well. But this was the positive for me. And it's something I've taken with me and encouraged others. Listen, you're not going to have every voice represented at the table. You're not going to necessarily know every language or understand every culture. But the idea is that if you know two, you know three, you become exponentially more sensitive to what's around you, which is a good thing.
Yeah, I really appreciated your talk. And from my own cultural background, I was intrigued by the three influences in your life. And I have to first say that being that my family has been in the United States, having immigrated from Japan, at the end of the 19th century, your Japanese is probably a lot better than mine. And so I say that as a preface to a story that I still kind of remember from my childhood about another aspect of things we can learn from different cultures, and specifically from my own cultural background, which is that there is this sense in the Japanese culture of wanting to teach you about really difficult choices and contradictory situations. And one for my life as a Christian that kind of stuck in me, and I apologize for more knowledgeable people in the audience, there was this idea of this samurai who was loyal to the emperor, but he was expected to go after his father, who was a rebel, basically. And so the most important thing was to then be loyal to your lord, more so than anything else. And I think a lot about that when talking about leaving your family and then following Christ. So I was wondering whether you had picked up any of that aspect as well, in addition to this idea of accentuating the brokenness, whether that was anything that you might have heard of or might be familiar with.
Yeah, what a beautiful comment. Thank you so much for sharing that. The first thing that comes to mind for me is not necessarily from Japanese culture, although there may very well be some, and I'd have to think on it for a minute. But it is actually, I think, this comment and question very much linked to Say's question, which is that my experience as someone with strong Japanese, American, and Hindu Indian influences has made me want to find touch points. What I mean by that is, I was having a conversation with a colleague who was a Christian and viewed Buddhism as ultimately evil. And I mentioned to them that I don't see it that way. That's not how I approach it. Right? Even though you and I have a shared commitment to Christ, I don't see Buddhism in that way. And they said, well, tell me one thing that you value about Buddhism. And I said, Buddha saw that the world was broken. And he was shocked and put in utter despair about the brokenness and the sin of the world. Most of us walking around don't engage with the reality that there's brokenness and that there's sin. Now, Buddha may have veered in a different direction about how to remedy that, but and I believe only Christ is the remedy, but the fact that there is this acknowledgement of deep and profound brokenness and sin in the world is a prerequisite to being able to embrace Christ in a very real way. And I, I feel sad that many Christian brothers and sisters sometimes don't even see that the depth of the brokenness and sin there is. So it's made me much more sensitive, I guess, is what I'm trying to say, in what a lot of these traditions are really about, rather than being reductionist about them, really understanding them more deeply, which almost always reveals touch points with Christ that I couldn't have imagined before.
Praveen, thanks so much for that. I've never heard you tell your own personal story in that length, and I found that very helpful for understanding who my friend is. Thank you very much.
Thanks, Ted.
But I also wanted to thank you for the shout out to Percy Julian. Students who graduated from Messiah in the years I was teaching them as seniors, they know who Percy Julian was. And he was probably the most important African-American scientist until this generation. And yet hardly anyone knows who he was. And I also wanted to ask you whether you've, because of your comments about Jesus and power, have you read a book called The Upside Down Kingdom?
No, I have not.
A former colleague who's a sociologist wrote this, and it was a religious book of the year in the 1970s. But it's about the Gospel of Matthew and about Jesus and power.
Thank you, Ted. I'll take a look. Thank you. Please.
Hi, good night. So I have two questions, or maybe one question with two different sides of it. So you mentioned a bit about your own personal story and being raised, born and raised Hindu. And when you came to Christ, how you had to navigate that relationship and, you know, make it clear that you're not going to change your name. You're still you with the same cultural background, just now with a different faith. So I wanted to hear a bit more about, all the years after, how you continue with this relationship with building your faith and having that duty of like discipleship, but still, you know, maintaining this relationship, these familial bonds with others. So that's one side of the question. And the other side is the academia side. So you are a professor and you lead a department. And again, we are called to discipleship and to minister to others and to engage in these discussions about faith, even while existing in science. So like we essentially have to be missionaries, but not in some remote corner of the world, but, you know, even in our classrooms. So my question is, how can we balance standing firm in our faith and being mission-oriented in our faith to critically engage with others without disrespect? Yes.
Great question. Maybe what it all comes down to, really. I've thought a lot about that. Maybe I'll start with the second one and work my way back and see if I can remember the first one by the time I'm done talking. I am really passionate, actually, about this topic of what ministry and evangelism in the workplace looks like. And a couple of things I want to share about this, if you can bear with me. The first is, and I alluded to this in my talk as well, my posture toward people, if I'm going to engage in ministry, has got to be that we are image of God to image of God, right? This isn't hierarchical. This isn't me coming with some great wisdom that they need to hear. I might have wisdom for them. I think I do. But most assuredly, they have some wisdom for me. And if I'm open to it, I can see it. God can reveal it to me. I really believe that. And it's borne itself out in interactions with colleagues. I really believe people can tell the difference. They can tell the difference with whether you're engaging them as someone that you genuinely respect, that you believe is an image of God, that you believe deserves dignity, and that you think can teach you something, versus this posture of, I'm here to, save a lost soul. I've been on the other side of that. It doesn't work that well. And so I have fresh memories of what it felt like when people engaged me that way, right? I felt like a project and not someone that they could learn from just as well. Right? So I really try to create in truth, not as a strategy, but in genuineness, in sincerity. And I often will prevent myself from talking about Christ if I feel like my posture toward the person isn't good. I feel convicted about that. I really want to have the right posture toward people and then ask God to speak through me. The second thing is, I don't often, I'm not sort of thinking all the time about how I can talk about Jesus. And it's not because I don't care about sharing my faith with my colleagues. But what I have found is it's really easy for my colleagues to dismiss me when they don't really know me. When it's hard to dismiss me when they know me, right? So after the seventh or eighth conversation and they're thinking, I want to collaborate with this guy, really like what he's doing in the department, I want to learn a little bit more about what he's up to, and then suddenly I'm talking about going to church or giving a lay sermon on Sunday and their brains are exploding. Right? And they're going, but at that point, there's a cognitive dissonance that's happening, right? And they're genuinely invested and engaged in wanting to hear more from me. Then we can have a conversation, right? But if I'm just trying to, you know, feel like I'm doing my Christian part and keep talking about Christian things, it's mostly just going to annoy the heck out of them, right? And again, I've been on the other side of that. So those are some things that I would say about the sort of the posture and the approach toward ministry, toward my colleagues in the workplace. And I was prescient and knew that I would forget the first question you asked. Do you happen to remember? How have I been able to maintain a true and genuine devotion to Christ while trying to stay close to my family and my Indian roots and things like that? Yeah, it's not easy. That has definitely not been easy. There are, again, you know, as I think back to the last, you know, 22, 23 years that I've been a Christian, and the rest of my family, not my children and wife, but, you know, my siblings and my father, are not Christian. As I think back to those interactions over 2+ decades, what I realize has been the most important has actually been when I say things, not what. It's related to my first answer to your question. For the first 5, 6, 7 years, I didn't say anything to them at all. And it's because I knew, I understood where they were coming from. They had all kinds of perceptions and misconceptions about what it meant to be a Christian. And they were not ready. In my own prayer life, I could tell they were not ready to hear from me. So I didn't say anything. I just lived. I loved them to the best of my ability. I lived my life to the best of my ability. I would screw up, I'm broken, I'm messed up. They saw it in all its gory detail. And that's what it was. And it wasn't until 7, 8 years in that they would start asking questions. Right? Often it was through the political lens because that's one of the primary ways in which people interact with, quote, Christian voices. And so they would start asking me and they'd say, you don't really seem like this thing that I keep hearing about. Like, what's going on? Those kinds of things would provide an opportunity for me to share about who I was, how I think, why I think that way. And again, it came from their questions, and so they were invested in hearing the answer rather than me being really desperate to try to communicate with them. So the biggest thing has actually been patience, waiting on God for the right times and the right things to say. And that the reason why a walk with God is so important is because you better be ready, right? Because 8 years in, if the opportunity comes, you ought to be ready to go. To really be able to share about who you are and why you believe what you believe. So it's not up to you when you get to say these things and when other people's hearts are ready and prepared. So a lot of it was just giving them space and being patient. And they respected that a lot. And in subsequent years, they told me that, right? That, hey, you didn't come across as this, like, you know, Bible thumping, you know, trying to convert me, this sort of zealous kind of personality. You came across thoughtful, you came across patient, you came across sometimes unsure. And that was hard because in those moments I would think, oh gosh, they're going to think if I'm unsure, I don't really have faith. But I had to trust God that I too could be like that person who had faith, but had to ask Jesus to help my unbelief. And that somehow, I don't know how, but God was going to be able to work through that too. I'm still there.
One last question.
Oh, boy. Well, thanks, Praveen, for so many really interesting thoughts. My head is exploding. But you left me curious a little bit. You talked about your conversion to Christianity and these aspects that you brought out, diverse aspects and so on. But it wasn't your family. It wasn't a Brahmin like Jesus. But what was it in the nuts and bolts? I mean, did you start reading the Bible out of curiosity? Did you dare to go to church? Was it a mentor? Can you say just a few more words about that?
Yeah, sure. Yeah, thank you for the question. So it all actually started in wanting to better understand Hinduism. On the very first day of college, my roommate asked me, so what are you? With the idea of what do you believe and why? And I said, well, I'm a Hindu. And he said, okay, well, why are you a Hindu? And I was just shocked. I had no answer. No one had ever asked me. I hadn't really asked myself. And so I didn't have a practiced answer to give. And it really embarrassed me. And then I thought, I've been practicing this religion for 18 years and I don't have anything to say for it. So it gives me goosebumps to talk about it because God, there's nothing he won't do to bring people unto himself. And in my case, it was wanting to learn more about Hinduism. That's how it all started. And in doing that, you suddenly become more spiritually sensitive. And there were truth claims being made in the Vedas and the Upanishads and the Bhagavad Gita that I'm thinking, wow, this is really fascinating. But how does it compare to the truth claims of other religions? It was really the first time I really was explicitly asking myself those questions. And that's what motivated me to dive into the literature of Buddhism, the Quran, and eventually the Bible. I will say the Bible was the last one, and it was because I didn't want to study Christianity. The only religion I had any antipathy toward was Christianity. And I grew up with my father's stories of missionaries tricking people in India, hiding bags of rice behind a picture of Jesus and then the next day saying, see, now why don't you worship Jesus? This stuff really bitter taste in my mouth. And I didn't want to study the Bible. I didn't want to study Christianity. But I distinctly remember a day when studying the Quran that a thought occurred to me, and it could only have been the Holy Spirit, though I wouldn't have named it as such then, that if you're going to read the Quran, dismissing all of the actions that you might be able to identify from any individual Muslim, right? Well, then you better do the same for the Bible. And I realized I was being intellectually dishonest, right? And that I was operating out of this emotional place and this antipathy that had been built up because of my upbringing, and that it wouldn't be intellectually honest to exclude the Bible, right? And Christianity and the world's largest religion. And so it was still an intellectual exercise for me. But there's always a friend, isn't there? There's a friend who kept nagging me to go to church. And I kept politely telling him no for about a year. I had been trying to get into a psychology class taught by a world's famous psych professor at Cornell. And I couldn't get into the class. But lo and behold, that psych professor was coming to give a sermon at the First Congregational Church. And this friend was very clever. And he said, oh, Professor Moss is coming. I know you really want to hear him talk. And I went, and it was the first time I'd actually, despite having grown up here, entered into a church building. It was exactly what I'd seen in the movies. You know, people got up, and then they sat back down, and they got up, and they sat back down. And I thought, okay, well, that was fun, but I really don't need to go back, right? And I couldn't even tell you what Moss preached on. It was like the Stanford experiment or something. I don't know what he was talking about. And so walking back to the dorms, my friend said, well, what did you think? And I told him what I just told you all. And he said, yeah, my gosh, my church is totally different. And he was still being very clever. And it turned out he went to a First Assembly of God, which is like the other side of the spectrum from First Congregational. And I didn't know that. I thought church was church. And he said, I can't even explain it. You just had to come. And so that's what happened. Next Sunday, I'm like, my brain is just fire. And I'm walking in, and these folks are like, they've tossed their chairs aside. And it's like if whatever they were worshiping left the room, they were going to wither up and die. And I thought, my gosh, what is going on here? I've been to the temple for 18 years to worship. I've not seen this kind of worship. What was happening? And I realized at that point, my gosh, if I'm going to understand their behavior, I've got to read their blueprint. And so I asked him, hey, can you give me a Bible? And these were like days where like Amazon had just, it was like fledgling, and it took like 3 weeks for anything to come and stuff. And he said, already on it. He had already ordered it anticipating my experience. I was starting to feel a little bit like, what the hell, what's going on? But when the Bible finally came, I was like a kid in a candy store. And I didn't know why. It's just, I had this feeling something special was about to happen. But I couldn't have described or explained to you then why I felt that way. I really felt like a little kid at Christmas. And so then I started reading scripture, and Jesus blew me away. And for a long while, I only read the red letters. I just wanted to hear it from the horse's mouth, as it were. Right? And I did that over and over and over and over again until he began really disabusing me of my notions of what to expect out of a religious figure, right? Because he just completely countercultural. And like I said, it didn't immediately make me Christian, but a few weeks, maybe a couple months in, I remember reading on my back the verse about the cost of being a disciple, which are also Dietrich Bonhoeffer's words and famous book. And it was the first time I had to reckon with the fact that, my goodness, if I really make this decision, my world is going to flip upside down. My family may not talk to me. Worse, they may be deeply and profoundly hurt. How do I do this? And sometimes I wish I had the fire that I had back then. I barely knew anything about Christianity, but I had this sense that if God had brought me this far, he was not going to leave me high and dry. He would figure this out, you know? And I just said, I just dove right in. Yeah. Sorry, long answer.